anything.
They're amazing.
I guess that's what it's for.
Good morning. We'll call to order the first meeting in 2017 of the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And glad to see all of you here. We're going to kick things off with sort of a self-introduction time because we do have some new members. We have also some old members.
And some really old members.
In both ways, yeah.
Senator Roblin and Senator Thompson are experienced members of this committee. And Representative Smith Warner is an experienced member of this committee. And the rest of you all are relatively new to this committee. As you probably know, education is more than 50% of the total budget of this state. And so this committee is rather important. They do not provide us with a printing press, though, along with our responsibilities. We get to make some decisions about priorities. The big co-chairs will tell us, okay, here's how much money you have. Now, you know, where do you want the cuts to be made? And that's a difficult assignment, one that we take very seriously. Let's do self-introductions. I'm Senator Rod Monroe. I have been in government for 40 years. I'm a lifelong educator. I have served both as a high school teacher of advanced history and government, AP level. I've also taught at the college level at three different colleges. I've been a decade on the David Douglas School Board. I've been another decade on the Mount Hood Community College Board. Spent 15 years on the board of Warner Pacific College. So I've done both public and private institutions. My wife, who often accompanies me, makes sure the computer's set up properly. Billy is also a retired teacher, and so you'll be seeing her around quite a bit. I couldn't do this job without her. It gives me a lot of pleasure to have Barbara Smith Warner as co-chair, replacing Representative Betty Comp, who I worked with for almost a decade as head of this committee. So with that, Barbara, you want to say a few things?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you to my colleagues on both sides of the building and to the LFO staff. I'm Barbara Smith Warner. I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. And I am the daughter of a college teacher and the parent of two Portland Public School students. And I have long been, as I like to say, when my kids started school, my belief in public education went from the abstract to the concrete. And so I have been very pleased to get to be involved in the Ways and Means process here in the Building on Education, because it brings you such a wide perspective and you learn more every day about all of the many people and organizations who all really want the same things, which is what is the best work we can do to educate our students in the state. And it's the whole range, as people say, cradle to career. And we deal with that all in this committee. And it's a great learning process every single day. And I'm particularly excited that we do have a mix of members who have been doing this for a longer time and members who are new to the Ways and Means process, but certainly not new to support and involvement in education. And I also believe we bring a really nice range of perspectives on what on priorities for all of us. I know looking at my House colleagues, they truly bring a wide range of experiences and beliefs and values, and we all share that overriding value that education is the most important thing that we do, I believe, as a government, as a state, and as a people. So I'm very happy to be here and look forward to an exciting and thought-provoking couple of months of conversation here as we work through this extremely important process.
And as we get on with things, please, each member should feel free to speak to either myself or Barbara anytime you have any questions about anything that's going on. With that, I'd like to introduce Senator Arnie Roblin. Arnie is the chair of the Education Policy Committee in the Senate, so it's kind of a good balance to have the chair of the Policy Committee also on the Budget Committee, so that hopefully we'll be on the same.
The biggest problem with it is that it's harder for the Policy Committee to say that it was Ways and Means destroyed another great policy.
yes. Go ahead, Arnie.
Which we do like to say from time to time. So I'm Senator Arnie Roblin. My district is District 5. It goes from just south of Coos Bay at the bridge into Charleston. So I don't have the southern part. And then goes to the whole west side of Tillamook Bay. If you look across the state, it starts at about Roseburg and it ends in the middle of Portland. So that's the length of it. And then inward, it goes into Territorial Road in Eugene in Lane County. And then up takes all of Lincoln County, and then takes part of Yamhill and Polk counties, all of Sheridan and all of Falls City. So it's one of those larger western districts. I think only Pierzanski has more square miles. And because I have 3 miles off the coast, I get a little bit more water than he does. But education has been my life. I started as a math teacher at Marshfield High School in 71, worked there for 32 years, ending the last 14 as the high school principal. And at the same time I was ending my last year, I was in my campaign for the first term in the House, served 8 years in the House, 4 years in the Senate with just elected to the next 4-year term. It is exciting for me to be on this committee. I have been on an education committee just about every term except when I was co-speaker. And it is deeply a part of who I am and where we need to go in Oregon to help make things work for our kids. And in almost that whole time, we've been in, at least in our district, because we had a hard time getting a tax base in the early days, in fiscal crisis. I mean, it's trying to figure out how to pay for the next year. And that does not make for a good education system. When we did have a good education system in our state, it was when my part of the state was paying for it with timber taxes and others. So if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, when timber was king in this county, a lot of money came from those industries to help the education system of the state. And we were ranked in one of the top states in the nation for a number of years. And then with the change from the property tax paying it to the income tax paying it, it made a real, totally changed the tenor of that. So the lowest tax rates in the state are in those timber counties, which used to have timber money. So you've got places like Curry County at 87 cents a thousand. You've got places like Josephine County with 57 cents. Because they were used to paying it through their hard labors and the work that they did. It changed at a time when they didn't have a chance to really understand they needed a tax base. It's been disastrous for us educationally since then. And we need to figure out how to balance those things and make. And education was a big part of why I came to the legislature. I also came because of the natural resources issues, but that's not this committee. Because rural areas have had a difficult time having an economy for the last 30 years. So that being said, look forward to being here. Really do enjoy Ways and Means. If you're just in a policy committee and you don't have the experience of going into Ways and Means, it's really hard to see the whole picture of what the legislature is doing. It's like you were saying with respect to I became concrete when my kids went to school. The legislature and its importance and how the state runs, where you meet that same issue is when you get on Ways and Means, because all of a sudden you start to understand every little nuance of the state is based on how we spend our money, and that happens in Ways and Means. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Arnie. I remember those days before Measure 5. I was chair of the Revenue Committee in the Senate, and I was the author of the school safety net. Remember that?
I certainly do.
And I got a lot of flack for that because the school safety net simply said, if you can't pass a bond, then you get the same number of dollars you had the previous year with no growth.
Yeah.
And that kept schools open for a little while, but it wasn't adequate. And of course, we also have the pear farmer from Hood River, Chuck Thompson, Senator Chuck Thompson. Go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rod. I am, as you mentioned, I am the chairman of the and only member of the pear caucus in the building. I'm from Hood River. See, my background was 16 years as a county commissioner, also up there, so I have some budget experience there. Rod kind of raised the bar for me a little bit. I've only spent one session on this committee, but liked it a lot and glad they put me back on it. My experience in education, besides helping fifth grade math and those kind of things as a parent, like all parents do, my wife was a school teacher. She still substitutes. And my sister is a lifelong teacher, probably going to retire in the next couple of years. So this to me is the most important committee in the whole building, and I'm glad to be on it. It's a team thing. We sit here and battle. Only thing I would like, I didn't know when I got on this committee that we also are the we oversee the Board of Accounting, the Board of Dentistry, the board. So it takes about a month to get through all that before we actually get to the education committee. I'd like to see that reversed to where we do the education first, and then we can do the boards anytime. But anyway, glad to be on it. And Rod is absolutely correct for the new members. Anytime you have a question about anything, I know Rod is great, and he'll take a meeting with you anytime.
And Gene Wisnett, welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
New member of this subcommittee.
Well, I served on this committee three sessions.
That's right. Back, what was that, 07?
Yes, sir. And my first session, 05.
Yep.
And I've worked with a lot of, not the new members, Diego, but everyone on the committee on certain. The co-chair and I are working on an important bill this session. Senator Rowland and I worked on the most important bill, our taxpayers' transparency.
Oh, yep.
Senator Monroe and I worked on visual screening together with the speaker. And pass that, but I'll look forward to it. If anyone's out there really watching us, I hope not this morning. I'm Gene Wisnett, proud to live in Sun River and represent House District 53, which is with the last redistricting shrunk in size. I had all the county except the city of Bend, and that's really geographically been decreased, and I now have almost 20,000 in the city of Bend.
Oh, wow.
Because Ben's too big for one state representative. I have served, I think, six of my eight sessions on either education policy or ways and means. Currently serve my third term session as vice chair of higher education, which this committee also looks at. So I'm also a member of the NCSL Standing Education Committee and have been a commissioner of the Education Commission of the States. So look forward to it. Challenges, and sure we can find $200 million to get to current service level. And that our co-chair's leadership. Look forward to working.
Welcome, Gene. Thanks. Good to have you here. Julie, you're on.
Thanks. Well, I'm Julie Parrish. I'm the state rep from House District 37, which is Westland and Tualatin, largely. This is my fourth term in the legislature, my third term doing something education-related. So I spent 4 years on the ed policy, and back on ed policy this year with now this being new Ways and Means. I was on Ways and Means Natural Resources sub last term in the legislature, so not new to the Ways and Means process. I've got three kids in public school. And that kind of bring a unique perspective as a universal school choice supporter. I really believe strongly the public should pay for an education. I am more about giving families the choice of how that education gets delivered and as we customize education options for children. Two in high school, one in middle school. One of mine is actually high school / college. She's taking also coursework up at Clackamas Community College. Moved to our district, actually, as a almost lifelong Oregonian, but moved to our district actually to take a job in the school district, and I used to run our school lunch program, so I'm really interested in making sure that some of the wraparound services that we provide kiddos during the school day have strong support, whether that's food or vision screening or you know, the preventative health work that we can do with little guys in the classrooms to catch some of those early health issues that affect learning. And so my husband will be very excited to have people know that he just finished his middle school science fair on Friday in all the ice and got kids there. But he's currently working as the middle school, part-time as the middle school science fair coordinator in our district. He and I both have taught at one point or the other in college setting, him more than I. But, you know, so we're interested in education. And I come from a family where education wasn't necessarily valued. Only one in my sibling set to get a high school diploma. So out of lots of siblings, and I've watched what happens when people don't have a path to education. So to me, it's very personal, and that's the lens I will bring to this committee.
Thank you, Julie. Mr. Lively?
Thank you, Senator Monroe. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is John Lively. I'm state representative from House District 12, which is the city of Springfield. So it's fairly easy to describe what my district is. I appreciate your lifetime educator. I'm a lifetime educated. I'm one of those lifetime learners. I've spent my life learning. I love to do it, and that's partly why I serve in the legislature, frankly. My wife's a retired educator. Many of our family friends are educators. My oldest daughter is an advanced math teacher at Springfield High School, so I stay involved with education. I'm over 20 years as chair of the Facilities Committee for the Springfield School District and have served on multiple bond measure committees and things to help the district from that standpoint. Honestly, all the years my wife taught, I was a longtime volunteer in her classroom. Sometimes she didn't appreciate my help as much as others, but I did get to do that. So education, again, is very important, has been a very important in my life and continues to be, so I'm pleased to be here. I now have 7 grandchildren in the school districts, the public school districts, so I feel kind of the next generations that I need to be involved to make sure that they have the opportunities that I had and that my children have. Another reason to be here, this will be my first time serving on Ways and Means. When I was a city councilor and mayor, though, I spent a lot of time with budgets and have some background in a lot of the companies I worked in. I was responsible for the budget, so the financial part of it is, I think I probably complained enough to the speaker about budgets and things that she said, well, why don't you just get on there and see what you can do? So here I am. I'm looking forward to it, and thank you.
And welcome. It's good to have you, John. Mr. Diego.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. My name is Diego Hernandez. I am from House District 47, which represents a large part of East Portland, 102nd all the way to 162nd from Sandy, parts of Powell Division. I have 4 school districts in my district, Park Rose School District, Centennial, David Douglas, and Reynolds. I've been serving on the Reynolds School Board. I'm going to back up. I actually grew up in Oregon and am a product of public schools. I went to David Douglas and Park Rose and graduated from Reynolds. and actually went to the University of Oregon where I got my bachelor's, and then went to Portland State where I got my master's. So public education all the way for me. I've been serving on the Reynolds School Board for the last 4 years, hopefully going into my second term as a going up for re-election this year. And prior to that, I worked at Park Rose High School for Park Rose High School and Middle School for 2 years as a mentor and teacher, doing class. I had 8 classes and after school programs. And then after that, I've been running a nonprofit for the last 3 years, and now I'm here, and I'm happy to be here. I'm also the co-chair currently of the Policy Education Committee in the House. I'm excited to work with you all and get to know you more, and it's going to be a tough journey, but particularly because there's so many folks that in my district that are having a tough time. I serve on the Reynolds School Board, and high poverty and high needs and high homeless rates, so they are looking to us to do something. Thank you.
What years were you at David Douglas?
I was in David Douglas 3rd and 5th grade. I don't know what years those were.
I think you were probably at the high school in the 90s when I was chair of the school board there.
Don't make me do math, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you. Barbara?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd just also like to point out that we have an additional colleague, Representative Susan McLean from House District 29, who is in the audience today. And as a longtime educator, speech coach, activist in education, she is, while she does not serve on the committee, she is planning to stay actively involved through observation and consultation with all of us. And I just wanted to call her out and recognize her today and thank her for being here and for her continued interest and work in this subject.
Yes, Susan and I go way back. We served on the Metro Council together for a decade or more, I think. So she has a strong background in education and interest in, and Susan knows where my office is, so if I'm doing anything I need her help on, she'll let me know. And
she was also a debate coach when my son was debating in those days.
And we have the able assistance of Mr. Doug Wilson as our committee administrator, and Doug is a lot of help, and Barbara and I will be meeting with him on a weekly basis, and he's basically helped set the agenda for this committee, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about that right now. I forgot to say there's very strict rules for subcommittees that we cannot begin without a quorum of both the House and the Senate. So please try to be here on time every day, and that way we'll be able to knock it off, because we have to have two senators and we have to have at least three House members before the gavel can drop. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, first of all, I also want to introduce Julie Jensen. For those that were around last year, she reappears this year, or this session. I'm not sure how long she'll be with us, because she is going to grad school also for special ed, if I'm not mistaken. So welcome her back too. What I'd like to do is just go through, there's sort of three parts of this presentation. I don't think I'm going to get it done. We'll have to slip it in over the next couple of weeks at some point in time. But the first is sort of just the subcommittee process, and that for you, we'll go through that real quick. Most of you understand that. The next is sort of what we've done, not necessarily in subcommittee, but sort of budget 101. The full committee co-chairs wanted, since there are quite a few new members or members who haven't been on Ways and Means for a while, to go over the budget process real quick, some of the underlying foundations to that and some statewide numbers. And then finally, I have a number of slides if we get to it today, but I'm sort of thinking we may not, on education generally, on the education program area specifically. So that's the game plan, and I'll move along quick, but feel free to ask questions and make sure we go through the chair to keep the subcommittee process right. So this is also, the first few slides are also in a memo, but I just threw them on part of this presentation, but it's basically we do start at 8:30. As Senator Monroe mentioned, the quorum issue is we're no longer going to be operating where we can start a meeting without a quorum. The practice now will be we'll have to have at least three House members, two senators. So it's important to give myself or Julie a call, or you can call one of the two co-chairs and their staff will call us if you cannot make it for some reason. If you know beforehand by a couple days, please let us know. So if we know there's going to be a quorum issue, we'll try to deal with it. There are no specific subcommittee rules. They're part of the full Ways and Means rules. They are posted on OLIS for today's meeting, and they were passed by the full committee last Thursday, I believe.
And Doug, there is a rule that the big co-chairs are members of this subcommittee and can sit in at any time. However, they get really cranky if they get called because we're lacking a quorum. So don't do that.
And because you need a quorum to start, there will be no longer the practice of opening as a subcommittee of the subcommittee, a thing that's been done in the past, but it's not allowed for this time. Just keep in mind and page your cell phones and those things if possible. Make sure they're on silent or off. If there is a need for a roll call, which hopefully there isn't on a regular basis, Julie or who's ever sitting in as the committee assistant will call the roll. There's an order that they follow, depending on who's chairing the meeting that day. And keep in mind that the information posted for the meeting is on your OLIS account. It is the practice of the Ways and Means and LFO staff that we will not make hard copies generally for you. You either have your computer or please use your staff if you want a hard copy. Agendas, notices, public hearings on the bill for the first time, which are the budget bills in this committee and limited fee bills, are required 72 hours posted. We have posted this week and we will post next week, relatively soon, probably tomorrow. And those hold up, those time frames of 72 hours for first hearing and 48 hours time or posting for bills that have already been held at first public hearing. But toward the end of session, you'll find out that we start flying around here since we end up with a number of policy bills in this subcommittee and in Ways and Means, and at some point in time, you're going to much shorter notices. What we'll do is a daily agenda, which is on your chair or at your desk, and then the practice of this subcommittee has been to try to give you next week's agenda sent to you via email on Friday during the day sometime, so you can prepare if you'd like over the weekend or as you move into the next week. We put a list of the budget bills in front of this committee also on the OLIS for today, along with the LFO analyst assigned. You will see me almost all the time except the first couple weeks, because I've now picked up public universities in addition to I have the full realm of the P to 20 system now for education as we make some adjustments in staffing in our office. We'll spend the first probably two and a half months doing phase one, which are sort of overviews, mission goals, performance measures. What are the programs? How are they operating? How are we measuring success? And some on the budget drivers, but not digging deep into the budgets. That's for phase two, where the governor's budget will be spent a little time on that, but plus special topics that come up during phase one, if you want to dive deep into something. Last year, we spent 3 or 4 days, if I remember right, on early learning, because it was quite a bit of new programming coming in. And then phase three is the work session. Most of them will be for education toward the end of session. The licensing boards that you will hear that Senator Thompson mentioned will be slid in at various times, but we will get their overviews done in the first couple of weeks, so starting education later. So the tentative schedule for the presentations is for the next 2 weeks, this week and next, we'll do the health licensing boards that are also assigned to this committee, get them out of the way, and then we'll start and do education the rest of the time. We'll give some time to the chief education officer, a couple days for overview, do his budget, teachers licensing and our standards and practices board, and then into ODE, the state school fund, and then finishing up with HEC, which is the Higher Education Committee. Or Education Coordinating Commission, excuse me. Electronically, you'll find a number of things that are in front of you the first day of the hearings. We post them on the first day of the hearings on OLIS. And for work sessions, when we get there, we'll provide a background memo and then a number of standard work session papers that we will go through that are in the same format for every agency. Some agencies have a single subsection, for lack of a better term. Many have, when it comes to Higher Education Coordinating Commission, there's probably 17 to 20 different program areas in that budget because of its size and the variance that it has in its program. So you'll either have very short and very thin work session documents, or you'll have very thick ones that will take a while to get through for ODE and for Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Keep in mind there are budget notes, and I'll explain what they are real briefly a little later on. But it is essential that you clarify. They are there to sort of provide further direction to the agency, maybe require a report or a direction that goes along with some budget. They are not policy. In the past, people have tried to slide what are essentially policy bills into budget notes. You can't do that. Budget notes, I would suggest you go through the two sub-chairs, but they must be approved by both of the full committee co-chairs, and I would also suggest that you bring them to the LFO staff, and we can write them for you based on what your intent and content want and direction that you want to provide, and we can then put them in the proper form, and you can submit them at that, or we can take them directly to the co-chairs for their approval also. When it comes to passing the bill out, there will be the chair will, from each side, the co-chairs will appoint a carrier for the full committee, one carrier, and then of course you have to be a member of the full committee, so that does limit at least on the House side who can carry, but on the House floor, or on the House and Senate floor, carrier will be selected. We'll write you a pony, what we call a pony, which is essentially a speech for you to read to make sure the motions are right and the numbers are right. Of course, you can expand on that if you want, but we do suggest that you at least read the pony initially before expanding, because it does have the information you want to get on the record. And LFO staff will be in the chamber, will sit on the side aisle unless you specifically ask either the carrier or someone else in the committee to sit with you at the desk to respond to questions. And we're willing to do that, but we'll only do that when we're asked specifically to do that. So that's sort of the subcommittee overview. The next phase is sort of to go through some of the role of our office and what we have in the past called Budget 101. And I'll go through this quickly, and if you do have questions, please let me know, and I can help any staff or any member after the meeting or at some point in time if there's something you want to dive down into more specific. Ways and Means is an important committee. In fact, the only thing that the legislature truly has to do every 2 years is pass a budget. And there are three sections of the Constitution there listed on the screen. All in Article 9 that lay the foundation for that role, and then the statutes provide further direction on how the legislature and how the governor and the executive branch present the budget and how you work through it. I won't go through this, but it just shows you the foundation for what the legislature has to do. The policy, which is partially drawn out in the statutes, is that we balance estimated revenues and proposed expenditures. We look at outcomes and the desired outcomes when allocating those dollars. We measure program outcomes and the progress toward those outcomes. Encourage savings and investments, and that's important this time around given the problem with the shortfall that presents you at this point. We also try to take a look at both the short term, which is the current biennium, and long term as you pass the budget, thinking what that means one or two biennia out also. If you load up at the back end of this biennium or proposed biennium that you're working on, you're going to have roll-up that is significant the next biennium. And there is some of that in this budget that we're having to deal with. And finally, providing accountability. In terms of meeting outcomes and following through on the budget on the executive side. LFO, we've been around since 1959, nonpartisan, fully independent set of professional staff for the legislature. The E-Board was created at the same time that the Legislative Fiscal Office was, and that was a constitution. The E-Board is in the Constitution, I believe. Our role is to provide objective research, analysis, and evaluation of state expenditures, provide any assistance we can to be members. We serve the entire body, both the Senate and the House, all members, but you'll find out just we spend more time with members of Ways and Means and the co-chairs than we do with other members, but we're there to serve the entire legislature. This is our org chart. As you can see, there's sort of two big roles during session. There are down in the bottom left-hand corner, we have four or five positions that do all the fiscal impact statements. So that's a staff that they have limited committee assignments. In fact, the staff you will see in the next 2 weeks are those folks that do fiscal impact statements because they've been assigned a few budgets, but their major focus are providing services to the policy committees in terms of fiscal impact statement. The senior analysts and the principal analysts are the general or are the budget analysts that are in front of the subcommittees and work with you. And finally, two of the principal analysts, and this is a growing field for us in a sense over the past few years, are IT analysts. They're very trained in IT, and that's become a larger and larger role for our offices in evaluating IT projects, just as we do for budgets. Session responsibilities for us. Like I said, we serve the entire body, spend a lot of time with you. There are generally seven committees or subcommittees, policy-wise, six of them. And then there's the Capital Construction Committee, which has a little more power and a little more clout than some of the other committees because both the Speaker and the President are on it. And that's where a lot of the end-of-session bills will be flowing through, mostly the big bills that you'll see in the final few days of session to close it out, including capital construction and bonding. LFO analyzes the budgets, provide you assistance. We take a look at what the impact of budget reductions or enhancements are. We make formal recommendations to you on work sessions. That's different than some of the other committees in the building. We do provide you formal direction. Some of that is coming from us, but we are also sometimes the conduit between the full co-chairs and the subcommittees, making sure that what they have proposed is in front of you and acted upon. We respond to questions. We collect information for you, so please feel free to give us a call at any time. And as I mentioned before, we provide fiscal impact statements to all the committees in the building. And we also assist members on the floor when requested. In the interim, we have a number of responsibilities. Of course, the Emergency Board and Interim Committee on Ways and Means. We provide staff to the ongoing audit committee. And so we do some auditing, not the same auditing as the Secretary of State does. We do limited program evaluation when the time is around. We spend some time, both our principal analysts that are IT analysts, as well as the budget analysts, looking at IT projects a little more in depth. We do some publications and presentations for that matter. And then we provide the oversight on the state or on the budgets for the agencies that we're assigned to and make sure they're carrying that out, as well as gaining knowledge for the next session. There are some other responsibilities. We provide a report on liquidated and delinquent accounts. We sort of do some oversight on semi-independent boards. These are boards that the budget doesn't come to you, but we do provide some oversight on them. And there's also a number of task forces that we either assist with or staff directly. Our major staffing is
Mr.
here.
Chair.
Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, back your last slide, please.
Yeah, figure out how.
Could you please comment on reviewing state agency budget execution and operation? Can you go into that a little bit, shortly, briefly, please?
We are... Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I mean, it's more of an informal relationship. I often attend a lot of the board meetings. I meet with directors and executive directors on a somewhat regular basis, spend time out in the field with their staff, seeing how projects are run. We do try to do some field work, as we call it, and so it's more of an informal. We do review allotment plans informally, even though that's really an executive side. I'll talk about that in a couple minutes of what they are. So
thank
it's
you very much.
Over a number of functions.
Thank you very much.
Staff, we staff the e-board, which now only meets in the second year of the interim. Because the joint there's the interim Ways and Means meets before the February short session. There's the audit committee, as I mentioned. There's a IT management and technology committee that is staffed by our office, as well as a Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission. A couple of our staff on our staff provide the assistance for that that commission. Real briefly, the process of the budget. I'm checking my time. We need a clock up here now, I think, now that I'm sitting here. it's a two-year cycle, biennial budget. Most states, I believe, work, most states our size work on a biennial budget. Larger states often have annual budgets. There actually has been in the past talk about the feds going to a biennial budget some. But even though it's a biennial budget, since you come back in February, you don't rewrite the budget, but there are many times you may augment it or, in some cases, have to decrease it, too. But there is some rebalancing that goes on. But if you go around clockwise from 12 o'clock, you'll see that the process agencies follow through the allotment plan, which is there mainly for cash flow. They provide quarterly allotment plans to the Department of Administrative Services, saying how much they plan to spend over the next 3 months, and they are kept to that. That's loaded into the accounting system, and they have to amend that, but it's there mainly for cash flow to make sure agencies don't go through all their money before the end of the two-year budget cycle. Number two there at about 3 o'clock, agencies implement the budget, they follow through, they load it into the accounting system, and then monitor it so they don't overspend. Number three, they can come to the e-board for emergencies. Now, emergencies has a wide definition. It was originally to be a true emergency. I don't think that's the case anymore, but they can request funding from the emergency board. They can request expenditure limitation increases, or in some cases, mainly for DHS, DOC, OHA, they can rebalance their budget between programs in it. Number four, agencies start putting together a budget probably soon after or during the February session, starting to work on the next two-year budget cycle. Then by late summer, they have done what is called the agency request budget, submitted to the governor and to the chief financial officer's office, which is the governor's budget staff, who during September, October, and into November put together the governor's budget. Then that is submitted to you. And then you work on during session, of course, what is essentially the legislative adopted budget. The odd year session is the budget session. We're just starting that. The governor's budget is due December 1st to be submitted to you, except when the governor is new, and then he or she has until February 1st to put together a budget, since she is elected quite late in the governor's process. We work with legislative leadership in terms of LFO staff and the co-chairs to prepare a working budget in the sense of what they've called the co-chairs framework at this point. And we also start to put together the review documents that go through it. The leaders and co-chairs then set priorities, set timelines. We provide information as LFO staff in terms of making recommendations on budget issues, spending issues, and various options. You all meet, work through the budgets, have a work session as a subcommittee, make your recommendation to the full committee, and then the full committee passes a budget out, and it goes to both floors. Keep in mind, Ways and Means is a joint committee. It's really two committees together because it does take a quorum on both sides, but the efficiency or the effectiveness is in part you don't have to send things through a budget hearing two times, one on the House side and one in the Senate. It's jointly heard. It's separately voted on, both at the subcommittee and the full committee. You vote at the same time, but you were voting based on the votes on both sides of the table. But then when it comes back from passing the first floor, it passes through our office. Gina, who is our committee administrator in a sense, does the paperwork, and it goes to the other side. And that's the same with policy bills toward the end of session. That's why you'll see a lot of policy bills, one of the reasons. The other major reason, of course, is they have a fiscal impact. Going into sort of the budget process itself, I know some of you know this very well. There's general fund, which is fungible. It can be spent on any lawful purpose that the state has. There are lottery funds. These are actually other funds that are limited, but they are dedicated to economic development, education, the parks and salmon habitat. But because it makes up, a lot of it goes into the state school fund, it becomes partially fungible too in reality. Other funds and federal funds, other funds are things like the gas tax, PERS expenditures, cigarette tax revenues that are spent. These are other funds. Federal funds are things like Medicaid, food stamps, children nutrition programs or school lunch programs. And then we also have something called limited and non-limited categories. You basically limit other and federal funds. You limit the expenditure that the agency can provide. There are some expenditures that you do not limit, but there are things that are like the food nutrition programs, for the money comes in for that specific purpose, and we don't tell the agencies you can only spend that much in terms of the law. They do have to follow through in the allotment process. And then there are some federal funds that are also non-limited. You'll see those are like the school lunch program. There's also other funds that are non-limited. I believe the PERS benefits are non-limited. They flow through the state budget, but we don't limit it. They're non-limited. There are budget categories, to give you an understanding of that. There are personal services, which are basically employee compensation and benefits. Services and supplies, those are costs to operate state government. Rent, travel, office supplies, legal expenses, those kinds of things. Capital outlay, these are major expenditures generally for capital construction that generally take 2 years or an extended amount of time to do, construction projects, large investments. Then there are major construction or acquisitions. These are capital constructions if you're building a building, building a prison, whatever it might be. Some of the IT projects fall into the capital improvement and acquisition area. And they often get six-year limitation in terms of building projects because the time span, not IT projects necessarily, but the construction projects. And finally, there's debt service, which is the aftermath of capital construction, which is a growing part of our budget in education, which I'll show you hopefully today, but maybe a little later on. The budget, not the bills themselves, but the budget reports and the underlying process does track position number of positions and FTE, and you'll see that continually through that. So,
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair. Very briefly, Mr. Wilson, in the past, some agencies have been submitting data on vacant positions. Are they going to be required to do that again, please, each agency?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, actually state law, ORS, does specifically require the agencies to do that. And they generally will report vacancies and often at zero in on those vacant positions that have been vacant for 6 months or more.
Thank you.
Continuing on, appropriation bills are budgetarily controlled. They are session law, not part of the Oregon Revised Statutes. They're not detailed to the expenditure category like personal services and supplies are generally a line item. The budget report goes into a little more detail, but budget execution is where that kind of detail gets into the mix. They are appropriated or limited at the fund type, so you'll see a general fund appropriation, and other agencies you'll see other fund limitations, federal fund limitations, and then also define what non-limited expenditures the agency may have. I've talked a little bit about budget reports. Those are directions and detail on what the subcommittee does and what's more included more specifically in the budget, and then the role of budget notes. Again, they are not to provide statutory direction, but are to provide direction more and in terms of how to execute the budget or for things like a report that they need to come back to the emergency board on. Keep in mind, the budget is a plan to spend money. It is not necessarily the legislature saying this is specifically how you spend it. There is some specificity to it, but agencies can move money around on a limited basis as long as they're staying within their appropriation line or category. So let's say you said we were going to spend this much money on for this staff. If the definition of their program is wide enough, they can redirect some of that. They should not do that very often, because it does make the legislators sometimes unhappy. So and also you can move money between categories. Vacancy savings are something that are used often to cover unexplained or unanticipated costs because of rent increases or snow days for Department of Transportation, whatever it might be. Appropriation bills are all either $5,000 on the House side. Senate budget bills are always in the $5,500 series. Unless we get too many, then you might slip into $5,100 and $5,600 respectively. There are about 90 agencies, ranging in size from about $400,000 to over $10 billion. Smallest now, I guess, is the Citizens Initiative Review Board. The largest now is Oregon Health Authority in terms of the pure all funds or total funds budget. Budget bills are limited to appropriations. The appropriation bills themselves are not supposed to have any policy in them or any other subject. So LC says that they interpret that as meaning appropriation bills can't have any substantial or substantive language in them. We do have something called the program change bill, which is used mainly at the end of session to implement any sort of policy changes to implement budgets that haven't necessarily been part of an earlier policy bill. So that is called, and it comes out with the other bills at the end of session, the program change bill. We've talked a little bit about the subcommittee roles and responsibilities already. I won't go into any more detail, but there is a chance that you will see a federal grant or two come forward from probably Oregon Department of Education. The statute does require that the Ways and Means process review and approve any new application for federal money. If it's an ongoing thing like the Medicaid, they don't need to. But if there's a grant for some specific purpose, they are to get subcommittee and full committee approval. Those do not have to go to the floor, though, or either of the floors. You will hear reports mostly during the budget presentations from agencies that were required to report back, whatever its subject may be. Those are often laid out in the budget report and required through the budget report process. There will be some informational hearings. I guess this by definition is one. There are some fee-related bills. I think there's only one assigned to this subcommittee at this time for one of the health licensing boards. And then there are policy bills mostly toward the end of session, often have a financial impact or are tied to assumptions in the budget. But at the end of sessions, you may be having a day with four or five policy bills in this subcommittee toward the end of session. So, excuse me, I think I'll try to run through this section and we'll see how much time is left. This is sort of statewide budget information. Most of this, Mr. Rocco has put together. It is in the current 15-17 legislatively approved budget. just so the terms, there's two terms, legislative adopted budget. That is what you put out at the end of the budget session. Mm-hmm. So there will be a legislative adopted budget whenever June 30th or whenever the session is over. And then it turns into, as you amend it during the session, the e-board or the February session, it becomes the legislative approved budget. I don't know why, the background on that, but that's the nomenclature. So in terms of budgets, this is legislative approved. So I believe these numbers are through the December e-board. So it includes whatever changes have been made. As you see, that the general fund represents about a quarter of the budget. Lottery funds are a small amount, but less than a percent and a half of the budget. Other funds make up the vast majority of over 40% of the budget, but that also has some large payments like PERS, capital construction, employee benefits. Some of those things are part of that. And then there are federal funds. Most of that is likely in Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, and some in ODOT and a number of other agencies. But primarily a lot of that is Medicaid and what used to be called TANF and food stamps. I'm not sure exactly what the terms are now that are used. You'll see that from the 13 to 15 budget, there was an 8.5% increase. If you divide it back by program areas, human services, excuse me, is probably the largest single one, but education represents combined between the state school fund, post-secondary, and the other parts of the budget underneath you in 15-17 represented over 50% of the budget, state school fund being the largest single entity in that, representing just under 40%. Health and human services is a large amount. It's not only the what you traditionally think that come out of that those two budgets, you know, Medicaid, TANF, welfare assistance, child welfare. It also includes the PEB and OEB, Oregon Educator Benefit Board payments that are gone out. So that's part of that 44.3% too. I think it represents about $3 billion of that $31 billion. And then under administration, you might think that's such a large shape of the pie for that. The largest single item in there are the PERS benefits that are paid. They're non-limited, but they are part of the budget. So that was the total funds. This one was the total funds. In terms of general and lottery funds, where most of your discretion is, this is where, the education represents over 50% of the budget. It was only 17% or so under the total funds budget. When you look at general and lottery funds, it's a much larger proportional piece of the pie. Human services is about 26%. Public safety is a little over 16%. That includes the judicial branch. And then the rest of those budget areas are relatively small. But the state school fund is by far the largest. Over time, you can see how, by the fund types, how the budget is growing. You can also see there, this is the total funds or all funds budget, includes general, federal, and other funds. And you can see there have been some periods of relatively flat growth and some periods of relatively accelerated growth during those periods. The general and lottery funds, again, the more discretionary funds that you have control over. This shows the last 30 years, of that period. You'll notice in the around the turn of the century, around year 2000, there was a flat period. You probably remember that, the recessionary problems there. And you'll notice the flat period around 07, 09 through 09, 11. It actually went down in that 1 year, and that was during the last recession that we've been recovering from for a number of years. General fund and lottery funds have grown significantly in the past couple biennia, as you can see on that chart. If you take a look at how the budget goes out, by far, this is the total funds budget. By far, the greatest amount, almost 75%, goes out to special payments. Those are payments to various groups, whether it's school districts, counties, individuals. those are most of the money that comes into the state and spent by the state goes to someone else, specifically not to state employees. Debt service represents about 4%. The personal services, which is the state employee compensation, is about 10%. And then there's services and supply, about the same amount, and capital outlay. So by far, it's payments to organizations, local governments, and individuals that make up most of the budget. Budget issues, these are the key drivers on the statewide budget. Nothing surprising here, population growth, various changes in the demographics, inflation, both medical and regular inflation, something that is going to have to be watched very closely this biennium, which are the federal policy changes that are taking place. There's still great uncertainty, not only in health care, but even in parts of the education budget that we get from the feds, what those might look like in 6 or 7 months. And February might be an important session to redo some of the budget items just based on the changing federal portions. Lawsuits play a large role. Some are small, some are basically quite large and have effect on individual budgets. The initiative process, you'll see in education this time, that is playing a very large role with ballot measure 98, and a somewhat smaller role with the outdoor school ballot measure 99. Roll-up costs, we'll explain that a little more in education when we get there. Of course, PERS costs are having a significant impact on the budget this time around, as it has in the past few biennia. One-time revenues, another impact in this year or in this budget because of the federal health care dollars that we have received in the previous biennium.
Representative Parrish.
Real quick on sort of the budget drivers. Yeah. You know, since I've been here, our population has grown by about not just under 4%. The budget's grown 30% since 2011. Do we have, like, what, comparatively other states, like what their trajectory of growth is, or, you know, if they're not growing, is there a good place we can look at cross-comparative information? I mean, I know that there's sometimes right or left-leaning think tanks that produce different documents for different states based on how they're interpreting it, but is there something really neutral we can look at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, I can look for something, let's put it that way. I can't think of anything offhand, but for example, the Census Bureau collects a lot of government spending data as another sort of focus of theirs, and that might be a place to look. In fact, later on in the presentation, probably won't get to it today, is there's a table that shows state K through 12 spending that comes from the Census Bureau on state ranking. So that, I'll take a look at that in the next few days and get back to you.
Now, one thing that had quite an impact, of course, was when Measure 5 passed and we basically shifted education funding from local property taxes to state funding, and it made it look like the state was spending a lot more for public education than it was prior, and that's true, but it was mainly because of that big shift. Yeah, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, could you just talk briefly about mandated caseloads? And what specifically that means and where that is primarily found?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair. Mandated caseloads are primarily found in public safety around prison forecast, OYA to a certain extent, but the big one in public safety is DOC's population. The DOC doesn't have a large control over them. It's DAs and the courts that do in terms of intake. In education, it is school-age kids, even though that's growing very slowly. This year in the projections, the estimate we use was about 4.4% per year. So less than 0.5% growth in the number of students in each year. And it hasn't been growing very much lately in terms of the student population. But the big ones are in And the ones that have seen variability and growth are in the human service and medical. So it's the Medicaid caseload, the senior caseload, the TANF for public welfare caseloads, and the various components of the healthcare sector. Those are the, when people think of mandated caseload, those are the ones you see.
Thank you.
Okay. And then I was mentioning replacement of one-time revenues. That's important this time in the budget, because part of that $1.8 billion hole is due to federal funds we've used in a previous biennium that are not going to be available this time around, or not to the same extent. A lot of that is in the healthcare area. These will be the major budget issues facing you in the next this upcoming session. Of course, rebalancing the 15 to 17, you'll see a bill relatively early in the session. There are some programs and some dollars that need to be moved around to make sure that that happens, that we get through this biennium in a balanced way. There will be new revenue forecasts. Of course, the May revenue forecast is one that the budget really is worked off of. You'll be looking at how hard or how easy it is to continue the current general fund programs and services, probably more how hard it will be because of the budget deficit. There'll be a number of proposals from the governor, as well as from legislators themselves and the stakeholders. There are the potential issues we've talked about already about decreased federal funding and the uncertainty in federal policies on that affect state governments across the nation. Compensation issues, not only PERS issues, but also pay issues. Responding to successful ballot measures. There were three that passed this time, the Measure 98, often called the CTE, but it's much broader than CTE. So around high school graduation. Yeah. There is ballot Measure 99, which is the outdoor school that the money goes to Extension Service. So both those are education measures. And then finally, and I can't remember the number, but there's the veterans.
96.
Okay.
Veterans.
And that, of course, is not necessarily in this budget area, but it does have an impact across the entire budget. And then finally, you have looking out in 1921, we encourage you not to only think about the next 2 years, but the next 2 years after that and even into the future as you put budgets together and what they mean for roll-up costs.
Yeah.
Because long-term, the economy doesn't necessarily get any much better in terms of the sites. You hear the term current service level around a lot. That is what you will be working off of in terms of officially off a current service level. What goes into the current service level basically is the cost tomorrow of what you're doing today, to put it simply. We take the services and everything you have for this biennium in the current 15-17. We make adjustments based on personnel, roll up of compensation increases, what the PERS, actually PERS actuaries tell us what their rates will be for 17-19. We make our debt service adjustments. The thing about debt service is we often issue all the bonds in the last few months of the biennium, so the cost rolls up quite a bit in the next biennium, but that's the way it's been having been done for years. There's a number of program phase-in costs. Probably the best example is the Oregon Promise program. It was only in operation for 1 year of the biennium,
yeah. And
only one cohort. And so it rolls up from the $10 million. If you did not have any statutory restrictions on $10 million per year annually, it would roll up to just less than $40 million. So if you really are going to run that program, it's going to cost you just under $40 million if you what the original intent is. There are $10 million annual statutory limits in statute right now. That program specifically is running slightly over what they anticipated, which is not surprising. It's a brand new program. It's hard to forecast. Only one state, Tennessee, had thought about it before, and it hadn't even operated before we started. So right now they're running a couple $1 million over. So you may have to change that $10 million limitation for 15-17, depending on what the final decision is. There are actually programs that do phase out at times. The best example are things like IT projects, probably, that are projects that you may take two years to do, and then they're phased out in the next biennium. Inflation, those are the two general inflation rates. There are exceptions to that that are known. There may be things like rents that have increased more than what, but there are the general inflation, the medical inflation rates.
Senator Roblin.
Are those annual inflation rates as opposed to biennial?
These are both biennial.
Both biennial.
Yeah.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Is the 4.1 medical, is that just for, is that like what we're paying for public employee health care? Is that wrapping the Medicaid population? Does that reflect, you know, what consumers are, you know, having to pay MOTA? Because it seems like those folks are getting a lot more than a 4.1% adjustment. So whose 4.1 is that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, it's been a while, so I'm guessing a little bit, so I'll get back to you on the exact answer. But it is, for example, compensation for the health care benefits for employees, state employees, for sure. Okay. It does factor into some of the other programs. For example, like Department of Corrections has a health care budget. That is the beginning point. But there's also something called exceptional inflation. I think that's a proper term. I may be wrong. That if you know what it's going to be, then it's factored in into some of the programs. And that happens in human services area some.
Follow up?
So, thank you. So I'm hearing you say that that's really just our state cost, but we are not factoring necessarily the medical inflation that's happening for cities and counties who, of course, come to the state asking for money. We're not necessarily looking at that in the whole picture.
Not completely, Representative Parrish. We do when we forecast the state school fund. We get actuarially amounts or what OEB is going to factor in. So those are factored in for the calculation of the state school fund, which is by far the largest. And there's also fund shifts. I've mentioned that a number of times already. What's happening at the federal level is causing some issues around fund shifts and lost federal revenue. I'll start wrapping up here, this portion of it. This is the difference between the 15-17 and the 17-19 current service level and ballot measures. You can see that the various sort of components of current service level growth are factored in there. There are a couple things that are a little different that I need to point out. Ballot measures this time play a role that represents 12%. The cost of ballot measure 98, we're estimating at $294 million. The outdoor school is $44 million as it is in statute now. And I think the veterans one, I'm guessing, is 18 to 20 million, I believe. Thank you. Inflation is by far the largest, but the way we calculate this, for example, the state school fund, any school district compensation increases are really factored into that inflation. It's just the way, since it's a special payment that goes out the door and not direct employee compensation like it is for a state employee, that's a smaller amount, represents about 7%, and that will also include the PERS increases for state employees. All the PER increases, for example, for school employees are part of the inflation. Debt service has grown. That represents 6% of the increase between the two biennia. Caseload growth is about 12%. And then replacing one-time funds, this is a large amount this time because of the health care area, represents almost 20% of that increase. And then finally, just to show you, this is where we'll mention the co-chair's budget. If you take a look at these four bar charts, for lack, one is 15-17 ledge approved, one is what we calculate between CFO's office, the governor's budget staff, and our staff of what the CSL is. This includes the ballot measures. The governor's budget is represented by that third bar, and the red represents the new revenues that she assumed in her budget. It includes a number of items, but the major ones are tobacco tax increases, eliminating the partnership pass-through. Please don't ask me exactly what that is because I couldn't explain it, but it was a tax increase or a tax change during the grand bargain session a few years ago.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, you don't have to do it today, but you used the LFO, you're representing LFO, and you're saying the term $1.8 billion shortfall. For this committee, and I think for Ways, full Ways, it means I'm the $1.8 billion, a certain percentage of that is a one-time, to reference what you just said.
Yeah.
It's not a continuing increase in expenses for the state. Once we pay back the COLA, that's a one-time. So I'd like to know how much of the $1.8 billion is a one-time, filling some of the legislative or judicial actions for Cover Oregon and things like that as a one-time fill.
Okay. I'll try to get that for you. Of course, what is one? There's always a new set of one-timers each biennium, in a sense, too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Keep that in mind.
Roll-up costs are always critical, and that'll get to that. Senator Roman.
And you did say that the added costs for the health care were in that conversation about a one-time cost, even though they really aren't, because they're going to be ongoing, aren't they?
Keep in mind, the term one-time revenue is really when you use the revenue.
Exactly.
If it goes away, you're going to have a continuing problem.
That's what I wanted to make.
Thing. Now, my understanding with some of the medical stuff, it was a one- or two-time biennium thing, and now it's
forever
reduced.
Right.
So the governor included about $750 million that was not included in the co-chair. So that's why her budget is significantly higher than the what the co-chairs put out as part of their framework. They only had some very small amounts of additional revenue factored into there. For example, for the state school fund, they assume that $74 million of marijuana revenues, related revenues, will go to the Commons. Presently, it goes to the Common School Fund. They are suggesting, and it will take a statutory change, that it goes directly to the state school fund, and that is about a $74 million increase for the state school fund, if that's the case.
I've spoken with a number of superintendents and board members, and they always decry that the governor's budget will cause such and such a cuts to their district, and I tell them that's if you get the governor's budget, because it anticipates $800-900 million additional revenue, and there's no guarantees that revenue will be in place, and they kind of Senator Roblin.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So does revenue include things that she chose not to spend on, like the state hospital, like OPI? Is that considered revenue in her budget in that 7.48, or is that just no taxes?
Think so.
Mr. Co-Chair or Senator Roblin, those are the new revenue.
Just the revenue. Okay,
those,
that makes sense.
The state hospital or whatever it might be are budget cuts that are over and above those.
Okay.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Since I'm new to looking at it this way, what would be helpful for me, and maybe we'll get this later, is to see this comparison you have up there that goes back a couple more bienniums. So one of my concerns has always been, so how much does this grow? I mean, if I look at 2015-17 and then the next one, that growth rate seems pretty substantial. I don't know if that's what's always happened every biennium, but it would be helpful to me to be able to see over a couple previous ones how much that percentage increase was versus what's happened this year, so I can understand better.
And you get a sense of that here.
A sense of
the percentages is what you're after.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Going back to one of the things that you sort of were like, can't figure out how to describe it. It's the small business tax rate change, which we passed in part of the special session. It's interesting that we consider that an expenditure when it's you set a tax rate versus like, here's this tax credit type of expenditure. Is theoretically, if we're not paying 15%, those of us who pay 9.9% is an expenditure, right? The delta is an expenditure. So I guess I'm kind of curious how we're wrapping that up as an expenditure when that was really about changing a specific tax rate.
And you're talking, I think, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, I think you're talking about the pass-through. Again, I don't know any of the details, but it is a revenue to the state. And what the governor proposed was going back to what it was before the session. So the taxpayer would be paying more, or whoever is, and that's an increased revenue to the state.
But it's follow up.
Go ahead.
But that's actually not an, I mean, if we change the tax rate for a class of taxpayers across the entire board, I mean, that's not really an expenditure the way, I mean, it would take a 3/5 vote to actually raise it because it would be a new tax increase.
I'm assuming that's the case, but again, I would have, I'm not the tax expert.
Okay, thanks.
I think that's correct.
Yeah.
I think it's a good place to cut off.
Good place to wrap it up. Okay.
Dirty, wonky tax stuff.
No, it is. You. It's actually a good place because the next slide is that.
Okay. Oh, thanks, thank Mr. You. Wilson. I appreciate that. I've taught classes on state and local government and given many speeches about the Oregon system. And I always have stated, and I absolutely believe, that the joint ways and means process is one of the great strengths of the Oregon system. If you compare the way we do things to the federal government, for example, where they have a Senate budget and a House budget, and then hopefully they can somehow mesh them together and beat out their differences, and it sometimes works and it often doesn't work. In Oregon, we have one budget. The Joint Ways and Means Budget. That's why we have House members and senators on every subcommittee and equals numbers of House members and senators on the full Ways and Means Committee. Almost equal. Proportional. And, of course, some people... Yeah, there's more House members because there's more House members, but it's pretty equivalent. It's pretty close. And I've often said that I think this gives us great advantages in terms of getting our budgets done. We have also a serious disadvantage. We have to have a balanced budget. Federal government can borrow and borrow and borrow. We can't do that. We have to have a balanced budget. Now, we can borrow for capital needs with certain limitations. But generally speaking, come next June or early July, we have to have a balanced budget. That means we have to have a majority of both houses that agree on any new revenue, 60%, and that agree on the budgets, which will be cuts. And many of us may be reticent to vote for the restricted or cut budgets that we're going to be faced with. So it's going to be a tough job, folks. Appreciate having you all on board, and I know all of you will take this position, this job, really seriously.
We have had opportunities, Mr. Chair, for us to go the way the federal government does with respect to House Budget Committee and Senate Budget Committees. It happens rarely, but it has happened.
I have been around when that happened. I remember when some previous speakers and previous Senate presidents decided to separate the Ways and Means process. I think that's a tragic mistake. I would resist that ever happening again, but it could. That's right. Anything else? Madam Co-Chair.
It's been
tomorrow at 8:30.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate all of you, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. We've been in students.
Coaches don't have any options.
Yeah. We've been in students.
Coaches.